Welcome to Reclaiming the Republic. This show is sponsored by Mobius Strip Press. I am G.R. Mobley. If you go to my site, reclaimingtherepublic.org, you will have access to my content and support documents and links. This is an educational grassroots program leading in restoring the Republic and placing the federal government back into the scope and framework of the Constitution once again.
And welcome back. Well, we've got 19 citations from the Virginia ratification debates left. So the longer it takes to get to reading, the longer it's going to take to close these out. And I think realistically, we will definitely be done probably Monday or Tuesday. But with that, I want to also just inform you that this show is also sponsored by ReclaimingTheRepublic.org as well as RepublicReview.org. I will also say this, be very, very careful in what you do these next few days, because just based on what you can see in what's going on in the world and so forth, and then understanding the gravity of the fact that we no longer have a militia, it is a very realistic opportunity for political operatives to seize the day by trying to call unconstitutional martial law. If that happens because of the hyperbole regarding the pandemic of, you know, coronavirus or what have you, whether it be a duality of the meltdown of the, you know, the world markets and all these other things, just be mindful that the federal government does not have the constitutional authority to call martial law and impose a standing army. They must deploy the militia as it was defined in the Constitution by the framers who sold this Constitution to the states. We've read through this. Everybody that is aware of these facts understands this. And so the one thing I would ask is that you make sure you get this word out. You make sure that other people know this and understand that there are parameters, there are requirements that it calls for, or that I should say, the constitutional terms and definitions as provided by the framers when they were ratifying this Constitution clarified that that martial law could not just be imposed upon America, that it was to be in tandem with the deployment of the militia, and only in those states where the militias, not the National Guard, not, you know, the federal enforcement agencies, not the United States Army, the militia, the state-owned and operated militias, which have been marginalized and in non-existence. So I'm hoping that, you know, calmer heads prevail, and I'm hoping that, you know, we can, you know, get through this. I understand what nefarious men can do, because history has shown us this. And so with that, I just one more advice, please be careful out there, right? And so let us go ahead and move forward. As you know, you are still listening to the only show that provides the academic based evidence solutions necessary in getting the federal government back into the framework of the Constitution. Wouldn't that be awesome? I mean, seriously, would that not be probably the paradigm shift that we would need to unleash our economy and actually start putting our perspective straight in undoing the globalist grasp? Because obviously, you can see just how nefarious, just how dark the globalists have become, allowing China to do live organ harvesting, allowing them to deploy the coronavirus on their own people, and then exporting it around the world. It seems like it seems like the only place where you don't find the coronavirus in an outbreak mode at all is in South America. What the heck's going on? Venezuela and those countries are immune? Anyway, anywho, the listen line number is 605-562-4209. And so with that, Let me go ahead and jump into George Mason's comments. And these comments are coming. What day is this? Let me see here. This is Monday, June 16th. So this is after all of these debates regarding the militia and so forth. And so this is what Mr. Mason says. Mr. Chairman, gentlemen say there is no new power given by this clause. Is there anything in this Constitution which secures the states the powers which are said to be retained? Will powers remain to the states which are not expressly guarded and reserved? I will suppose a case gentlemen may call it an impossible case, and suppose that Congress will act with wisdom and integrity. Among the enumerated powers, Congress are to lay and collect taxes, duties, imposts, and excises, and pay debts, and provide for the general welfare and common defense. And by that clause, so often called the sweeping clause, which is the necessary and proper clause, and he continues by saying it, they are to make all laws necessary to execute those laws. Now suppose oppressions could arise under this government, and any writer should dare to stand forth and expose the community at large the abuses of those powers. Could not Congress, under the idea of providing for the general welfare and under their own construction, say that this was destroying the general peace, encouraging sedition, and poisoning the minds of the people? And could they not, in order to provide against this, lay a dangerous restriction on the press? Might they not even bring the trial of this restriction within 10 miles, within the 10-mile square? When there is no prohibition against it, might they not also destroy the trial by jury? Would they not extend their implication? It appears to me that they may and will. And shall the support of our rights depend on the bounty of those men whose interest it may be to oppress us, that Congress should have the power to provide for the general welfare of the Union? I grant, but I wish a clause in the Constitution with respect to all powers that are not granted, that they are retained by the states, otherwise the power of providing for the general welfare may be perverted by its destruction. Now, what Mason's doing here is Mason is plugging his Bill of Rights. And remember, he already wrote a Bill of Rights for Virginia, and how great would it be? It would be a permanent mark on the Constitution that would exude Mason's hand, just like the Declaration of Independence recognizes Thomas Jefferson to this day, right? So anyway, Mason goes on and says, "May gentlemen whom I respect take different sides of this question. We wish this amendment to be introduced to remove our apprehensions. There was a clause in the Confederation reserving the states respectively every power, jurisdiction, and right not expressly delegated to the United States. This clause has never been complained of, but approved by all. Why not then have a similar clause in this Constitution in which it is more indispensably necessary than in the Confederation because of the great augmentation of power vested in the former? In my humble apprehension, unless there be some clear and finite expression, this clause now under construction will go to anything our rulers may think proper, unless there be some expression declaration that everything not given is retained. It will be carried to any power Congress may please." Now, this is George Nicholas's response. And as a matter of fact, Mr. Henry, before Nicholas has a chance to get up, Henry said, "Moved to read the 8th and 13th article of the Declaration of Rights," which was then done. And so now Mr. George Nicholas gets up and says this, "In reply to the gentleman opposed to the clause under debate, went over the grounds and developed the same principles which Mr. Pendleton and Mr. Madison had done. The opposers of the clause which gave the power of providing of the general welfare supposed its dangers to result from its connection with an extension of the powers granted in the other clauses. He endeavored to show the committee that it only empowered Congress to make such laws as would be necessary to enable them to pay the public debts and to provide the common defense, that this general welfare was united not on the general power of legislation, but to the particular power of laying and collecting taxes, imposts, and excises for the purpose of paying the debts and providing for the common defense. And so that right there is probably one of the best, one of the best, explanations of the general defense and welfare clause. That this they could not raise as such money as, they could not raise as much money as would pay the debts and provide for the common defense in sequence of this power. The clause which is affected, called the sweeping clause, contained no new grant of power to illustrate this position. He observed that if it had been added to the end of every one of the enumerated powers, instead of being inserted at the end of all, it would be obvious to anyone that it was no augmentation of power. If, for the instance, at the end of the clause granting power and collect and lay taxes, it had been added that they should have power to make necessary and proper laws to lay and collect taxes, who could suspect it to be an addition of power, as it would be no grant of power if inserted at the end of the clause. It could not then be subjoined to the whole. And so here he basically lays out the argument again against this belief that they could just run amok based on general welfare, necessary and proper. We'll be right back after this. Thank you so much. Reclaiming the Republic is more than an educational radio show. My intent is to also work with you and local leadership to promote matters of the Constitution and self-governance. This way we can all promote constitutional awareness within our communities and with our elected officials and public leaders. If you love liberty and sovereignty and recognize the federal tyranny that is threatening our lives, then we are asking for your help. And here are a few ways you can help. Spread the word about this radio show, Reclaiming the Republic. It is the only radio show in the world asserting a constitutional solution to federal overreach. Download and share our podcasts and content. Read, like, follow, and share our Mobiusstrip Press and Reclaiming the Republic pages on Facebook. Follow us on Twitter at Mobiusstrip News. Get informed about local groups in the area and get involved. Most importantly, become a constitutional warrior with your local leaders and demand that they begin applying constitutional tests to what they are doing and who they are supporting. Thank you. If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review as well as my description of the Republic Review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how Republic Review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you.
Okay, so the number to dial in is 215-TOP-TALK or 215-867-8255. Do not forget my three C's when you dial in. And let's get on with the dialogue.
Okay, so now Mr. Nicholas is back up. This is Tuesday, June 17th. First up that day was Mr. Mason. And then next up was Mr. Madison. And now Mr. Tyler. And then, we're still on the 16th. And the note that we're on, was just following up Mr. Henry and Mr. Grayson. The reason I'm telling you this is because he starts off with answering the two gentlemen last up. And so that, you know, I want you to understand who those two gentlemen were. And that's Henry and Grayson. Sorry for looking down ahead. Anyway, in answer to the two gentlemen last up, observed that though there was a Declaration of Rights in the government of Virginia, it was no conclusive reason that there should be one in this Constitution. For if it was necessary in the former, its omission in the latter could be no defect. They ought, therefore, to prove that it was essentially necessary to be inserted into the Constitution of Virginia. There were five or six states in the Union which had no Bill of Rights separately and distinctly as such, but they annexed the substance of a Bill of Rights to their respective constitutions. These states, he further observed, were as free as this state, and their liberties as secure as ours. So, gentlemen, arguments from the precedent were not good. In Virginia, all powers were given to the government without any exception. So, in other words, they had a general constitution and was different in the general government to which certain powers were delegated for certain purposes. He asked, which was the more safe? Was it safer to grant general powers than certain limited powers? This much as to the theory, continued he. What is the practice of this invaluable government? Have your citizens been bound by it? They have not, sir. You have violated the maxim that no man shall be condemned without a fair trial. That man who was killed, not seculum artem, was deprived of his life without the benefit of law and in express violation of his Declaration of Rights, which they confided in so much. But, sir, this Bill of Rights was no security. It is but a paper check. It has been violated in many other instances. Therefore, from theory and practice, it may be concluded that this government with special powers without any express expectation is better than the government with general powers and special exceptions. With the practice of England is against us, the rights are reserved to the people are to limit and check the king's prerogative. It is easier to enumerate the exceptions to his prerogative than to mention all the cases to which it extends. Besides, these reservations being only formed in acts of the legislature may be altered by the representatives of the people when they think proper. No comparison can be made of this without other governments he mentioned. There is no stipulation between the king and people. The former is possessed of absolute unlimited authority. Now, this is where Nicholas kind of takes a little bit of a change and looks at common law, and he says, but, sir, this Constitution is defective because the common law was not declared to be in force? See, right there, he's basically pointing out that the Constitution did not establish common law for the states to be embraced. It was left open, and this is what he says. What would have been the consequence if it had? It would be immutable, but now it can be changed or modified as the legislative body may find necessary for their community. In other words, that way Louisiana can actually practice civil law and people can actually see, and states can actually change going from common law to civil law or what have you. Now, common law is a superior, in my perspective, is a superior law. But let me go on, and this is what Mr. Nicholas says. But the common law is not excluded. There is nothing in that paper to warrant that assertion. As to the exclusion of a jury from the vicinage, he has mistaken the fact. The legislature may direct a jury to come from the vicinage, but the gentleman says that by this Constitution, they have no power to make laws to define crimes and prescribe punishments, and that consequently, we are not free from torture. And so I just want to point this out because this actually clarifies the limitations of defining laws and punishments. But the gentleman says that by this Constitution, they have power to make laws to define crimes and prescribe punishments, and that consequently we are not free from torture. Treason against the United States is defined in the Constitution, and the forfeiture limited to the life of the person attainted. Congress have power to define and punish piracies and felonies committed on the high seas and offenses against laws of nations, but they cannot define or prescribe the punishment of any other crime whatsoever without violating the Constitution. So if you want to ask yourself, does the federal government have the ability to define laws of drugs or criminal behavior, like taking, kidnapping somebody and going across state lines? There are laws that the federal government has created that are not within the Constitution. Mr. Nicholas goes on and says, if we had no security against torture but our Declaration of Rights, we might be tortured tomorrow, for it has been repeatedly infringed and disregarded. A Bill of Rights is only to acknowledge the pre-existing claim to the rights in the people. They belong to us as much as they have had been inserted in the Constitution, but it is said that if it be doubtful, the possibility of dispute ought to be precluded. Admitting it was proper for the convention to have inserted a Bill of Rights, it is not proper here to suppose as the condition for our accession of the Union. Would you reject this government for its omission, dissolve the Union, and bring miseries on yourself and posterity? I hope the gentleman does not oppose it on the ground solely. Is there another reason? He said it is not only the general wish of this state, but all the states to have a Bill of Rights. If it be so, where is the difficulty of having this done by the way of the subsequent amendment? We shall find other states willing to accord with their own favorite wish. The gentleman last up says the power of legislation includes everything. A general power of legislation does, but this is a special power of legislation. Therefore, it does not contain that plenitude of power which he imagines. They cannot legislate in any case, but those particularly enumerated. No gentleman who is a friend to the government ought to withhold his assent for it for this reason. Yeah, pretty powerful stuff. And, you know, I do like the way Nicholas kind of addresses the issues and so forth. This next one, it's a short one, is Mr. Madison. And Mr. Madison is following up Mr. Tyler, and before that was Mr. Madison. And this is on June 17th. And so Mr. Madison says he was surprised that any gentleman should return to the clause which had already been discussed. He begged the gentleman to read the clause which gave the power of exclusive legislation, because now we're talking about Article 1, Section 8, Subsection 17, right? And so anyway, he says he begged the gentleman to read the clauses which gave the power of exclusive legislation, and he might see that nothing could be done without the consent of the states. With respect to the supposed operation of which he denominated by the sweeping clause, the gentleman, he said, was mistaken, for it only extended to the enumerated powers. There you go. So in other words, the general legislation or the exclusive legislation and the sweeping clause, all of these things. It's the same thing with the Commerce Clause. It's the same thing with the Supremacy Clause, as well as the General Defense and Welfare Clause. They are constrained by the enumerated powers within the Constitution. Pretty simple. Anyway, Madison closes and says, should Congress attempt to extend it to any power not enumerated, it would not be warranted by the clause. As to the restriction in the clause under the consideration, it was a restraint on the exercise of power expressly delegated to Congress, namely that of regulating commerce with foreign nations. And so I want you to understand that the regulation of commerce was primarily with foreign nations, and how commerce was handled in between states to make sure states could not have economic warfare amongst each other. The federal government was to kind of play not the overseeing, you know, all controlling of everything being produced, but to ensure that one state didn't put unfair advantages. And here's a good example. California, with its emission controls and its standards that it started driving down the throats of the automakers in the 60s and 70s, what they did was violate the Commerce Clause. If California wanted cars to meet certain standards, then they needed to start manufacturing those vehicles to meet their standards. They had no constitutional ability to force Detroit and any other car manufacturer in the world to meet these arbitrary standards that they started creating. Now, granted, it's good to be, you know, a clean world and so forth, but there are constitutional limitations, and California had no constitutional powers to assert that, and the federal government protected them because in doing so, they created a petri dish where the federal government could grow its powers and reach. And so with that, we'll be right back after these two breaks.
Folks, I'm constantly providing you with case after case and giving you both the empirical information as well as irrefutable academic evidence that the federal government is operating well outside the bounds of the Constitution. In measuring outlays, the federal government is spending over 80% of your tax dollars on unconstitutional government. This is why we don't need a balanced budget amendment. We just need to enforce the Constitution. So what is it going to take for you to take a stand in getting the federal government back into the framework of the Constitution? To be clear, the solution is simple and does not require much work on any one individual, especially if everyone contributed to the effort. We only ask that you make a commitment today to contributing however you can and make the difference necessary for our posterity's sake. Send me an email at info@reclaimingtherepublic.org and let me know how you'd like to help so we can help you save our republic.
To become a citizen, one must take an oath to support and defend the Constitution. Those of us who are naturally born citizens are obligated and duty-bound to fulfill the same oath even though we're not required to take it because it is implied upon us at birth. This is why I cannot emphasize enough the importance in supporting businesses who are supporting our Constitution. We have to stop supporting businesses that have chosen to hide behind political correctness, and obviously we must stop supporting progressive businesses who are working to undermine our republic and our Constitution. Do not let businesses or organizations convince you that they are supporting the Constitution by supporting protests for social justice. By definition, social justice is the distribution of wealth, opportunities, and privileges within a society. In other words, they're calling for socialism, which is incompatible with individual liberty and individual sovereignty and our Constitution. With that, please consider supporting businesses who advertise on this show and this radio station.
That number to dial in is 215-TOP-TALK, 215-867-8255. And again, don't forget those three C's. And if you're ready to call in, the lines are open.
Okay, so Mr. Nicholas now gets up after Mr. Henry, and the conversation is now turned towards slavery. And so Mr. Nicholas wondered, that gentleman, Mr. Henry, who were against slavery, should oppose to this clause. As after that period, and he's talking about the 1808 slave trade clause that shuts down the importation of persons into the states independently, that the federal government then takes control over who can be imported or who can be migrated, and they take full control over immigration as of 1808 to shut down the slave trade. And he says, after that period, the slave trade would be done away. He asked if gentlemen did not see the inconsistency in their arguments. They object, says he, to the Constitution because the slave trade is laid open for 20 years, for 20 odd years. And yet they tell you that by some latent operation of the slaves who are now will be manumitted. At the same moment, it is opposed for being promotive and the destructive of slavery. He contended that it was advantageous to Virginia that it should be in the power of Congress to prevent the importation of slaves after 20 years, as would be put a period of the evil complained of, as the southern states would not confederate. Now, again, he's using this, the term confederate, in bringing the states together. And it's another word for the republic. But I just want you to understand, and I've told you this before, they really looked at this republic as a republic of a confederacy, not a federation. And he said, as the southern states would not confederate without this clause, because they wanted at least 20 years protection to bring in as many slaves as they possibly could, so because it was the concession. The original intent was to shut down slavery completely, and it was many compromises to actually get them to a point where they shut down just the slave trade as of 1808. Anyway, he asked if gentlemen would rather dissolve the Confederacy than to suffer this temporary inconvenience, admitting it to be such. Virginia might continue the prohibition of such importation during the intermediate period and would be benefited by it, as a tax of $10 on each slave might be laid, of which she would receive a share. He endeavored to obviate the objection of the gentleman that the restriction on Congress was a proof that they would have powers not given them, by remarking that they would only have a general superintendency of the trade if the restriction had been inserted, but the southern states insisted on this exception that the general superintendency for 20 years, it could not, therefore, have been a power by implication as restriction and exemption from a delegated power. The taxes could not, as had been suggested, be laid so high on Negroes as to the amount of emancipation, because taxation and representation were fixed according to the census established in the Constitution. The exception of taxes from the uniformity annexed to duties and excises could not have the operation contended for by the gentlemen, because other clauses had clearly and positively fixed the census. Had taxes been uniform, it would have been universally objected to, for no one object could be selected without involving great inconveniences and oppressions. But, says Mr. Nicholas, is it from the general government we are to fear emancipation? Gentlemen will recollect what I have said in another house, and what other gentlemen have said that advocate emancipation. Give me leave to say that clause is a great security for our slaves. I can tell the committee that the people of our country are reduced to beggary by the taxes on Negroes. Had this Constitution been adopted, it would not have been the case. The taxes were laid on all our Negroes. By this system, 2/5 are exempted, then the other added, and not imagine gentlemen would support here what they had opposed in another place. And so you can start to see that those men that went to the convention in Philadelphia for the Constitution were standing up to actually abolish the slave trade. I'm here to tell you that if you understand the where slavery was, and you got to remember, Virginia actually seceded for maintaining slavery. They left the Union for maintaining slavery and established their own capital down in Richmond. And that was the capital of the South, if I remember correctly. Anyway, long story short, you can see that there were plenty of men. And as a matter of fact, I believe Patrick Henry kind of identified and kind of use fear-mongering, saying that, you know, one of these days the Northerners will actually be able to take away your slaves. And so he was right, because there were calculations by those who made these, I'll call them compromises, because if you add up the math, the way the colonies were growing, there were more and more people coming in, white people, and I should say migrants, coming to America for opportunities than they were bringing slaves. And that's just because the agrarian society, they could only expand plantations and so forth so quickly to be able to use more hands. And so they knew that the North would start to outnumber, by the consensus, the South, and they estimated that maybe 20, 30 years after the closing of the slave trade, they would have they'd be able to start pressuring the South in getting rid of slavery. Here's the problem. I think Eli Whitney created the cotton gin in, 1790, 1791, 92, something like that, which kind of galvanized slavery into the South. But more importantly, they were actually outpacing. They saw the threat of the denial of slavery, or the growth of abolition and that movement in the North by abolishing and emancipating slaves in the North. And they actually saw this, and this is one of the reasons why they and it was a huge mistake by Monroe. I'd poke him in the eye if he was here. He should never have allowed the Missouri Compromise to dictate that new states coming into the Union had to be slave states. Missouri didn't want to be a slave state. Most of the states that were coming in, they did not want to be slave states. They wanted to have their own opportunity to forge their own future instead of being tied to an institution that didn't seem to bring, you know, a lot of luster and glamour except for very few men. And most of those men were deeply entrenched in the South. And so anyway, long story short, we've got some good insight regarding at least the Virginia perspective. The Virginia perspective was not all about abolition, and I hope that nobody ever walks away from this show thinking that they were all abolitionists, but the leaders at the Constitutional Convention did want to see the abolition of slavery, and they were all going in that direction, and it was the three southern states that did not buy into this. And they basically said, if you do this, then we're out of the Union. And it was probably the worst political compromise in American history. I think the next one was the Missouri Compromise. Now Governor Randolph is up, and he's basically following Patrick Henry. And he says, let me say that in my opinion, the adversaries of this Constitution wander equally from true meaning. If it were not to fatigue the House too far, I would go back to the question of reserved rights. The gentleman supposes that complete and unlimited legislation is vested in Congress for the United States. This supposition is found on false reasoning. What is the present situation of this state? Has she possession of all rights of sovereignty except those given to the Confederation? She must delegate powers to the Confederate government. It is necessary for her public happiness. Her weakness compels her to confederate with the 12 other governments. She trusts certain powers to the general government in order to support, protect, and defend the Union. Now, is there not a demonstrable difference between the principle of this state government and the general government? There is not a word said in the government of the powers given it, because they are general, but in the general Constitution, its powers are enumerated. Is it not then fairly deducible that it has no power but what is expressly given it? For if its powers were to be general, an enumeration would be needless. And so I just got to show you that they go out of their way, and they constantly go on and on about the enumeration of powers, and that the Constitution is not a general power. Why is it that people today, and people that are in government, and Democrats, and everybody else, looks at our Constitution, looks at our government, that they have all these, you know, full powers and general powers, that they can do anything that they want? That's the furthest thing from the truth. This Constitution was completely defined as a limited and defined Constitution. And so When we come back, we're going to have Mr. Randolph, or Governor Randolph, get into ex post facto laws and some of these other nice things that the Constitution also provides protections from and restrictions. So when we come back after these two promos, we'll be able to cover and hopefully close out on a couple more citations. So we'll be right back after this. Thank you so much.
Have you taken the time to watch our presentation on YouTube that provided an irrefutable argument of what we have to do to save our Constitution and our Republic? I know it's over an hour and 30 minutes, but you only need to watch the first 30 minutes. If you take the time to watch this presentation, I promise it will change your paradigm regarding what our Constitution is and what we have to do if we are going to save it, our liberties, our sovereignty, and our Republic. We already have answers to most of the questions that you might think of after watching this presentation, and we want to help you get to a point where you have a profound understanding of the audit and republic review process. This is why our bullet overview and flowchart of both the argument and process is available on ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. The sooner you get informed, the sooner you can get involved and make an impact. So go to ReclaimingTheRepublic.org to the Take Action page. That's where you'll find the video. Thank you so much.
To set the record straight, Republic Review is neither an Article 5 convention nor a convention of states. In accordance with Article 5 of the Constitution, this convention requires 2/3 of the states to apply to Congress to convene a convention with the intent to amend the Constitution. This convention is unable to solve our real problem, which is non-compliance to the Constitution, and would be dangerous to convene at this time. In contrast, Republic Review is the process of the states exerting its constitutional authority over the Constitution. An audit does not require an application to Congress. This authority is inherent to principal stakeholders of a contract. Why do we need Republic Review? Because this is the only way the states can deal with the federal encroachments into roles, responsibilities, and powers that belong to the states. To learn more about Republic Review, please go to ReclaimingTheRepublic.org to read my content and my model on the audit and Republic Review process.
Okay, if you want to join in on the dialogue, you need to call 215-TOP-TALK. That's 215-867-8255.
Okay, so Governor Randolph moves on, and now he starts covering restrictions and, you know, how powers that they're presuming are implied are actually not. And he goes on by saying this, but the insertion of the negative restrictions has given cause of triumph, it seems, to gentlemen. They suppose that it demonstrates that Congress are to have powers by implication. I will meet them on that ground. I persuade myself that every exception here mentioned is an exception not from general powers, but from the particular powers therein vested. To what power in the general government is exception made respecting the importation of Negroes? Not from a general power, but from the particular power expressly enumerated. This is an exception from the power given them of regulating commerce. He asks, where is the power to which prohibition of suspending the habeas corpus is an exception? I contend that by virtue of the power given to Congress to regulate courts, they could suspend the writ of habeas corpus. There is therefore an exception to that power in sections 9 and 10 of Article 1. The third restriction is that no bill of attainder or ex post facto law shall be passed. This is a manifest expectation to another power. We all know that attainders and ex post facto laws have always been the engines of criminal jurisprudence. In other words, a criminal justice system that has gone amok, where they start, you know, punishing good people and rewarding bad. This is therefore an exception to the criminal jurisdiction vested in that body. The fourth restriction is that no capitation or other direct tax shall be laid unless in proportion to the census before directed to be taken. Our debates show from what power is that exception. The restriction in the fifth clause are an exception to the power of regulating commerce. the restriction in the sixth clause that no money should be drawn from the treasury but in consequence of appropriations made by law is an exception to the power of paying the debts and the United States. So do you understand what he just said? That no money should be drawn from the treasury but in consequence of appropriations made by law. And those laws must be made in pursuant to the enumerated powers. This is an exception to the power of paying debts of the United States. In other words, they don't have to pay a debt if it is an unconstitutional thing. So in other words, if we have debt and we are, you know, we're paying for debt to China and the rest of the world for things, for social engineering, for wealth, for the welfare state and entitlement, those are not constitutional laws. We cannot take money to pay that debt, period. That debt is bogus debt when people are buying it based on the fact that we're spending all of this money. Anyway, the next restriction is that no titles of nobility shall be granted by the United States. If we cast our eyes in the manner of which titles of nobility first originated, we shall find this restriction founded on the same principles. These sprang from military and civil offices. Both are put in the hands of the United States, and therefore, I presume it would be an exception to that power. You know, when Obama was creating czars, he was actually creating titles of nobility. And there are others throughout the federal government that have titles of nobility. The last restriction restrains any person in office from accepting of any present or emolument title or office from any foreign prince or state. It must have been observed before that though the Confederation had restricted Congress from exercising any powers not given them, yet inserted it not from the apprehension of usurpation, but for greater security. This restriction is provided to prevent corruption. All men have a natural inherent right of receiving emoluments from anyone unless they be restrained from regulation of the community. An accident which actually happened operated in producing the restriction. A box was presented to our ambassador by the king of our allies. It was thought proper in order to exclude corruption from the foreign influence to prohibit anyone in office from receiving or holding any emoluments from foreign states. I believe that if at that moment when we were in a harmony with the king of France, we had supposed that it was corrupting our ambassador, it might have been disturbed that confidence and diminished that mutual friendship which contributed to carry us through war. The honorable gentleman observed that Congress might define punishments from petty larceny to high treason. This is an unfortunate quotation. Or the gentleman, because treason is expressly defined in the third section of the third article, and they can add no feature to it, they have not cognizance over any other crime except piracies, felonies committed on the high seas, and offenses against laws of nations. I can't emphasize that enough. I mean, the federal government has no ability to just start creating laws of crimes, you know, petty, what's the other word, felonies and those types of things. But the rhetoric of the gentleman has highly colored the dangers of giving the general government indefinite power of providing for the general welfare. I contend that no such power is given. They have power to lay and collect taxes, duties, imposts, and excise taxes, to pay the debts and provide for the common defense and general welfare of the United States, close quote. Is this an independent, separate, substantive power to provide for the general welfare of the United States? No, sir. They can lay and collect taxes and etc. For what? To pay the debts and provide for the general welfare. Were not this the case, the following part of the clause would be absurd. It would have been treason against common language. Take it all together and let me ask if the plain interpretation is not this: a power to collect and to pay and collect taxes and etc. in order to provide the general welfare and pay debts. on the subject of the Bill of Rights, the want of which has been complained of, I will observe that it has been sanctified by such reverend authority that I feel some difficulty in going against it. I shall not, however, be deterred from giving my opinion on this occasion, let the consequence be what it may. At the beginning of the war, we had no certain Bill of Rights, for our character cannot be considered as a Bill of Rights. It is nothing more than an investiture in the hands of the Virginia citizens of those rights which belonged to British subjects. When the British thought proper to infringe our rights, was it not necessary to mention in our Constitution those rights which ought to be paramount to the power of the legislature? Why is the Bill of Rights distinct from the Constitution? I consider bills of rights in this view, that the government should use them when there is a departure from its fundamental principles in order to restore them. This is the true sense of the Bill of Rights. If it can be consistent with the Constitution or contained additional rights, why not put it in the Constitution? If it be repugnant to the Constitution, here will be the perpetual scene of warfare between them. The honorable gentleman has praised the Bill of Rights of Virginia and called it his guardian angel and vilified the Constitution for not having it. Give me leave to make distinction between the representatives of the people of a particular country who are appointed as the ordinary legislature, having no limitation to their powers, and another body arising from a compact with which certain delineated powers. Where a Bill of Rights necessary in the former, it would not be in the latter, for the best security can be in the latter is the express enumeration of its powers. But let me ask the gentleman, where his favorite rights are violated. They are not violated by the 10th section, which contains restrictions on the states, as they are violated by the enumerated powers. Here His Excellency read from the 8th and 12th Articles of the Bill of Rights. Is there not provision made in this Constitution for trial by jury in criminal cases? Does not the third article provide for the trial of all crimes shall be by jury and were held where the said crimes shall have been committed? In other words, they're going to hold the jury and the trial where those crimes are committed. Does it not follow that the cause and the nature of the accusation be produced? Because otherwise they cannot proceed on the cause. Everyone knows that the witnesses must be brought forth before the jury or else the prisoner will be discharged. Calling of evidence in his favor is coincident to his trial. There is no suspicion that less than 12 jurors will be thought sufficient. The only defect is that there is no speedy trial. Consider how this could have been amended. We have heard complaints against it because it's supposed the jury is to come from the state at large. It will be in their power to have their juries from the vicinage in their local vicinity. And would not the complaints have been louder if they had appointed a federal court to be had in every county and in the state? Criminals are to be brought to this state from every part of the country to the general court, and juniors from the vicinage are summoned to the trials. There can be no reason to prevent general government from adopting a similar regulation. As to the exclusion of excessive bells and fines, and cruel, and we ran out of time. But with that, I know exactly where we are. We'll close out this last paragraph when we come back in our next episode. So please stay tuned, and we will continue to plug away on all of these insights regarding the Virginia ratification debates. I'm G.R. Mobley. We're reclaiming the Republic, and we need your help. God bless. The reason progressives are effective in instituting their policies is because they are united ideologically, financially, and socially. In addition, almost every billionaire in the world is funding a vast array of different groups, and these groups' efforts are to undermine our republic and our constitution. If you don't believe me, just Google donors to the Open Society Foundations. The only way we're going to successfully combat these efforts and take back our liberties, like our education system, healthcare, state lands, housing, labor, and many other roles, responsibilities, responsibilities and powers that belong to the states is by you and I and local businesses getting involved in supporting political programs and efforts based on constitutional principles. The best way to do this is supporting result-oriented organizations designed to take back our lost liberties. The ultimate result-oriented effort is Republic Review. So please consider contributing to the show and the organizations and activities that we are supporting by going to ReclaimingTheRepublic.org and go to the contributions page, and you can become a listed supporter of liberty.